Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network Genocide Studies podcast. Today, we will be discussing the book Mass Violence in Nazi-Occupied Europe, edited by Alex J.K. and David Stahl. And Alex and David, would you like to introduce yourselves to the audience and tell us a little bit about where you work and what you focus on?
Yes, by all means. Helen and Sasha. I'm Alex, and I teach at the University of Potsdam in Germany. And my main research interests are Nazi Germany extermination policies, including the Holocaust and genocide in general.
And I'm David. I study together with Alex at the Humboldt University. We did our PhDs together, and that's how I know him. And I have always thought I kind of work well with Alex because we sort of complement each other very well. He focuses much more on the Nazi Party, Nazi criminality, whereas my research interests have been more military history and particularly the Wehrmacht and the Wehrmacht in the East. And I think if I could just say one thing about a book like this, those two skill sets I think used to be viewed as being sort of separate. And a lot of books were written separately around those topics. But I think younger scholars and really anyone who's well-versed in this area now know that you really need to have a much more comprehensive knowledge of a lot of the literature that's out there. And that's why I think I've always worked well with Alex.
And so I guess this leads very nicely into why did you both decide to do an edited work of articles rather than writing a book together?
Good question. I think that's always the question one of the questions historians are faced with, whether to write a single author book or to pool the collective knowledge of experts working in the field and put together a collection of essays like this. I think that we wanted quite a broad approach, covering various aspects of mass violence in Nazi-occupied Europe, and therefore we decided to approach people working on areas that we were aware of but hadn't perhaps carried out original research on ourselves. And therefore, it seemed the obvious thing to actually put together a collection of essays with authors from different parts of the world, you know, Germany, Israel, the States, Britain, rather than writing a single or a dual author book.
One thing I would also add to that, and I remember actually the conversation very well in a Frankfurt pub, as so many good books start in pubs, and ours did too. You know, one of the things that's nice to chat to Alex about is just the enormous amount of literature that gets produced in Germany and the very fine scholars that are here, who in some cases really have no footprint in the Anglo-American world. And unless you have access to German, you really can't access these works. I mean, one of the things I notice as a military historian is people are always asking, oh, well, what did Germans write about their military history? And you know, military history in Germany has always been something of a taboo subject, and not for the wrong reasons. Not that I really want a taboo about it, but the issue is in the Third Reich, it was Hitler and so on who forced onto the universities the idea of doing military history. So you can imagine after the war that became a taboo subject. Much of the rest of the engagement with Nazi past has not been subject to that. So Germans do an enormous amount of work on the Third Reich, and it's first rate. And as I say, some of these authors have just never made it into English with their work. And I think that was part of that conversation. You know, we're talking about this person, that person. Not all the people we talked about and originally wanted to contribute to this in the end were able to. But we certainly got a good crop of very fine historians. And some of the work that's in here you simply cannot access in English. And that was very much part of the original concept. Again, like so many books, the idea did morph. You know, not everybody, as I say, said yes. And then you get other people who are hearing about the project and wanting to be involved with it. And I think it came together really well. But yeah, like all books, there's always a bit of a story for how they start.
I think one of the strengths of this collected essays is it didn't come from conference papers or anything like that. You guys had a kind of some specific things in mind, and I think you did a very good job at gathering these different individuals to bring together. So even though it may not be one person writing the book or two people writing the book, there's a cohesiveness that is undeniable. So I wanted to ask you the hard question. Why did you choose to discuss this as mass violence rather than the Holocaust, rather than genocide, rather than ethnic cleansing?
Very good question, and kind of a key question for the whole volume itself. We had noticed over the years that there's some excellent work on different aspects of Nazi extermination policies, not least on the Holocaust, also on other areas, but very few works that actually look at Nazi extermination policies as a whole. And during the Nazi period, particularly in the years 1939 to 1945, several groups, multiple groups, were targeted by the Nazis. And this isn't a coincidence. And I think it really helps us to understand why that happened and how that happened by looking at these groups collectively. And therefore, we wanted to produce a book with a more integrative approach. And I think the framework of mass violence rather than only the Holocaust or specifically genocide allowed us to take this broader, more integrative approach.
I mean, if I could just add one thing to that, I think Alex is right. And I think the question's also a good one. I mean, you know, the Holocaust, when you think about it, is such a huge field and it seems to encompass so much. At the same time, though, it's a testament to just how much criminality existed in that state, in the Nazi state, that, you know, that's certainly by no means all victims that are come under that heading of the Holocaust. And one of the things I really like, and it's actually one of Alex's additions, is, you know, when we sort of stood back and we're getting various contributors, and, you know, as is the evolution with these kinds of books, you have contributors who say, yes, I'll do you a chapter on this. But then for whatever reason, you know, work and family and all the rest of it, people don't always produce those works. And at the end, you're sort of confronting a set of essays that you have to then put together as a collection. Now, it was always the starting point that I think mass violence was something to do with what we wanted to frame this collection around. But that's also a catch-all term because there's just so much criminality. And we kept coming back to this idea of, well, what binds all this? And then I think, as I say, you know, it's Alex kind of saying, well, we've got this phenomenon of criminality that encompasses so many specific areas. And then we started, you know, dividing up all our essays, and we got a natural way of looking at the essays that are sort of, you know, it's the subdivisions of the book, looking at part one, Holocaust, part two, Sinti, Roma, part three, Useless Eaters. Now, that's a term that the Germans, I don't know if that works so well for non-German speaking Anglo-Americans, but that's a term that the Germans or the Nazi state used. And it does speak to a subset of victims that are not Jews and not, they don't fit into all those classic categories of Nazi victims. And yet they're a subset that is very large. You can also talk about Wehrmacht criminality. You can talk about the whole idea of memorialization. So all these different parts, all these different terms became parts of the book itself and the various authors who were writing for us. And so in some ways, the book kind of developed a sort of natural symmetry. We had a whole lot of different people doing a whole lot of different research, but that spoke to mass violence, and that's very much what we wanted.
I was hoping you could explain to our listeners how you decided to divide up the book and give us maybe some highlights from each of the sections so that they can have a better idea what the collection of essays comprises as a whole.
I think we started with broad areas that where we said, if we're going to do a collection of essays on mass violence, it has to cover these bases. We have to include certain topics because they're vital to understanding how violence worked in Nazi Germany and how certain areas of the Nazi state, and particularly in the occupied territories, they were saturated with violence. And so we said, clearly we need to address the different aspects of the Holocaust, and we ended up with 3 chapters on that area. Clearly we need to address the camps, you know, concentration camps, yes, but also POW camps, psychiatric wards where the mentally and physically disabled were murdered. So I think we had a broad idea of, yes, this needs to be in there. And then the next step was to approach people. So to ask ourselves, okay, who are the leading names in the field in these areas, particularly people who are maybe not so well known among English-speaking readers. And then beyond that, you're to some extent dependent on whether these people agree to write for you and or whether they have time. And I think time is a big question. Everybody seems to be busy in our field. And I think we gave a generous deadline, but not everybody was able to contribute that we would have perhaps liked. But as David said earlier, we certainly were able to put a group of people together who are experts in their respective fields. And they contributed, I think, very different but exciting chapters on the various areas.
I might also just go back to something I said before about, you know, the idea was, I think, originally very much focused on let's try and get leading names in German historiography to contribute to this. And that really speaks to 2 things. First of all, the quality of the work they do, the amount of work, and the fact that there's remarkably, for some of these people, very little of their work in English. Not everybody who we asked, and we asked quite a lot of people, could do that. And we were even offering the translation and all the rest of it. So, you know, some of these people are just very eminent, very busy, no question. But not everybody could contribute. And in the end, we ended up with some people, just in deference to what Alex just said, we did end up with some people who are known in the Anglo-American world, and indeed their main works, like Waitman Bourne is in English, and Martin Dean has got work on the police battalions in English and is, you know, well known. He's at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, or was at that museum. So, you know, like the book, like so many, it evolves. But, you know, I really think what really struck me in doing the volume and in reading these chapters as they would come in was the ubiquitous nature of the violence. And, you know, it's really a radicalization, as, you know, Holocaust historians have been writing for decades. It's really a radicalization from above and also from below. But you just see how unrestrained on so many levels the violence is, the willingness to engage in this, the variety of victims, and the complete lack of restraint. And that's something that it comes through again and again in these chapters. And often so to the detriment of the Nazi state. They are killing people who they often need. You know, so that's one of the things that very much struck me about the process of putting the book together. Maybe because you did ask about, you know, giving some sort of specific examples of some of our contributors, what they've been writing about. But one of the things I might start with is the chapter that Alex and I did, because I think it provides a very good example of where the respective skill sets in this area are perhaps best illustrated. I mean, in a field like Nazi Germany with such an enormous literature, it's, I think, a very bold historian who says, oh, yeah, I'm across everything. Because the archival material is so vast. And even just frankly, the secondary literature today has become so vast that anyone who claims they're across all of it, I'm always a little bit skeptical, unless they're in their 80s. And I could probably name a handful of historians who I might halfway believe that. But pretty much anyone else is playing catch up. And I think knowing that makes you a better historian. But for a lot of these topics, they are also enormous. So, for example, Alex and I wrote about criminality on the German army of the German army in the East. Now, that's a topic that's had a huge amount of literature on it. So what are we really going to contribute in 10,000 words? It's not some kind of rehash. What we started to discover, and this is the me being a military historian and Alex being much more a historian of Nazi genocide, is that I kept saying to Alex, I see time and again instances where people are dying in the East as a result of German army actions, but those actions aren't in the first instance intended to kill people, but that's the result of the action. And Alex would then pick up these points and talk to them in more detail. So to give you an example, we all know about the sort of classic first-class criminality of the Wehrmacht, shooting or assisting the Einsatzgruppen to shoot Jews, anti-partisan operations, the Commissar Order. These are well known. This is not what we're talking about. There's a whole subset of criminality that is looking at to what extent does the average German soldier have culpability for criminality. And the ways that I would notice that following my operational histories was, well, how do you sustain a German army in the East when they have a very high demand for fuel and ammunition? So where do they get their food from? Well, they're living off the land. What is the implication of that when you watch unit after unit after unit go into very small, very poor communities and take everything they've got? It gets to a point where they think when they get into these communities, oh, these Slavs are holding back food from us. We'll go searching and find it. So they start tearing the houses apart. And sure enough, they do find food because these people are trying to survive over a very, very long, cold winter. And once they find that, they take that. So what's the implication for that? Well, we all know about mass starvation. At the same time, we don't know about mass starvation because there's nobody in a lot of these communities to write the records, to provide a record. But that's an implication of German soldier action. Same thing happening when they get to the winter. They're starting to take the uniforms. Same thing, things happen when they're in the winter and they're kicking people out of the homes. What are the implications? Large numbers of people dying. This is because of German soldier behavior. But this is not classically what we discuss in German army criminality. So Alex and I have sort of come up with this idea, well, there's a subcategory, a sort of secondary nature of criminality that doesn't, because there is so much criminality in all these other regards, it doesn't really get much space in the discussion. And yet, who knows how many hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Soviets die as a result of this kind of behavior. And that deserves some sort of illumination. And I think if I could just say one more quick thing, maybe I'll hand back to Alex. I don't know if you've got anything more you want to add, but a lot of the chapters are talking about very specific things, but these things tangibly expand our knowledge of the criminality and the number of victims who are suffering as a result of this. Do you want to add anything else, Alex?
No.
Okay, good.
I think one of the other great accomplishments that you've both achieved with this book is you're not only pushing the boundaries of where German criminality is taking place, but you are taking it out of Germany, you're taking it out of Poland, you're taking it out of France, and you're dealing with other Nazi-occupied countries in Europe that are not very heavily discussed in the historiography. Was this your intention, or is it also just the luck of who was writing for you?
No, that was very much our intention. It's no coincidence that a substantial proportion of our chapters focus on the German-occupied Soviet territories, for the simple reason that the level of violence there goes beyond anything else in German-occupied Europe. So many of the major mass murder programs, forced labor programs, etc., took place in Ukraine, in Belarus, in the Baltic states, in Russia proper. So that was very much intentional. Also, because we think that certainly in the English language literature, these crimes and these territories are underrepresented. We don't know enough collectively about the suffering of the Soviets. It's believed that at least 27 million Soviets died at the hands of the Germans during the years 1941 to 1944. But who knows this? You know, who knows this in the English-speaking world? Or that the Soviet prisoners of war, more than 3 million of them, died in German captivity, in Wehrmacht captivity. That's the second largest group of Nazi mass murder after the European Jews. And therefore, yes, it was very intentional that we focused so much attention on the Soviet territories in particular.
I think the other thing I would just say to that is, I mean, we shouldn't think of all of this, and our introduction really does go after this. This is not all about history. Part of the thing that I find that I'm constantly battling against in talking to undergraduates, but also just, you know, lay people who ask me what I do for a job, is this isn't all, you know, we talk about the war years, but this has such a resonance in the modern world, especially in Eastern Europe. I mean, in fact, I was reading in the paper this morning about Poland and Russia just having a big dispute, an international dispute right now, because the Polish prime minister is not going to Yad Vashem to talk. And this is basically a dispute about the events of World War II. So, you know, there's a very contemporary resonance for this. And as much as we think this is German history, there's collaborators in all of these countries. And how those countries now deal with that is very much the subject of part of this book. I mean, the part five, memorialization, we have Ilya Altman who talks about how Russia is coping with the Holocaust in a modern sense. Probably a better way of putting that is not coping with it, not dealing with it, obfuscating that role where Russians are involved. Ukrainians are doing the same things. And then we got David Katz talking about the Baltic movement to obfuscate the Holocaust. And he has some very poignant discussions there of very much recent events that show just how difficult it is for modern governments and other political entities in these states to deal with their very real complicity in this mass violence. So in some ways, yes, the book is mainly about the events of 1941, 1944, or 45 in some cases, but to no small extent, this has a huge resonance in the modern world, and that's why this introduction, when we sort of opened up, we thought, do we do the classic approach of doing a big long historiographical essay and reviewing a lot of the literature in the field? And we did another book a couple of years ago on Nazi policy in 1941, and we did very much that kind of introduction. But we thought for this one, let's really try and front and center make that point about this being a very contemporary issue. So there's much more discussion about how have a lot of these issues resonated in the last few years politically, but also the fact that this isn't really a process that's at an end, partly because there's a huge amount of material still being discussed, still being discovered. And we talk about a lot of that, a lot of this new material that's been coming out only really in the last 5 to 10 years, which in some cases tangibly changes what we've understood. So it's very much a process that's alive. It's alive in terms of the evolution of the story, building those narratives, but it's very much alive in terms of the people who are choosing to interpret them, both historians. Sometimes I would put historians in inverted commas because I don't think they are historians. They are trying to come up with a political agenda justified in history. But there's plenty of, you know, people, especially in modern day Western world who have an agenda, a political agenda that seeks to sometimes manipulate this past. So it's more poignant than ever, I think, that we try and get that record right.
I think this is a very forward-thinking book, and I know that historians are always a little uneasy to talk about the present or even the future, but you guys have provided such strong groundwork to do this that I think the historiography's got to change. One of the things that you mentioned in your introduction that will later become evident in one of the articles that just kind of stopped me in my tracks is in many ways, therefore, Eastern Europe's struggles with its own criminal past, both Nazi and Soviet, is best summed up as a battle for history in which truth is malleable. And I think a lot of people can identify with that still going on today. And then also outside of Europe as well. Are there some other things that, Dave, you mentioned that there's new sources coming out all the time. Is there something that you would have liked to include in this book, but it didn't make it, but maybe in the future that something will come out of it?
I don't know in terms of new sources coming out. I mean, again, when one thinks about the enormity of this process, and I think it's difficult for lay people to really understand what that means. But, I mean, if I think about my archive down in Freiburg, I mean, that's just one archive, right? It's the German military archive, and the Wehrmacht was an enormous organization of 18 million men. Think about how much paper that generates. I mean, for any book I write, I'm down there multiple times, and I have to come all the way from Australia, so I know how far that trek is. But it's weeks at a time to be there, and it's a phenomenal amount of paper, which I can never hand on heart say for any one of my books, oh, I read everything in the period of that book, because there's just so much. That's true of the Nazi state in any area you go to. In fact, some of the books, if you bother to, you know, I'm always telling my undergraduates to do this, to flick to the back of the book and have a look at the bibliography or the section of archival research and see how many archives do some of these people go to. It's not uncommon. One of my recent students, so PhD students, went to, I think, 30 plus archives. So there's an enormous range of different places to triangulate any one of these very complex areas. And the more specific we become, the more that research process comes into play, because there's, you know, unlike me, there's not just one central archive where I can go to and get almost everything I need. It's much more a process of, and probably Alex can speak to this because his book on Filbert, which was an Einsatzgruppen commander, required much more research and trying to find and look at all kinds of different follow-up, all kinds of cold leads. And I remember for years hearing this story of being on the sort of the trail of Filbert. But at the end, You go through this process, you find all these things. So some of these documents that we're finding, I mean, one of them that we talk about, and it's by no means even the most important, but it was literally just someone who wanted to say, well, we're in Budapest, we'd like to make a hole in that wall. But at some point they had someone in the war had gathered up some 6,500 documents that they knew would be of interest to historians, but no ability to protect them. And basically what they did was they put them in this wall. And it was only by, you know, no one knew they were there. Someone in happenstance just decided, well, let's put a hole in that wall, found all these documents, and they would speak to a very specific part of one country, of one set of victims, of one area, of an enormous story for the Holocaust. I certainly have no expertise to speak to that, but we can definitely say that's an important source.
Although we work in the field of history, it's nonetheless the case that there are constant new developments in the sense of new studies being written, new documents being unearthed, as we discussed in the introduction to our volume. And this means that the publications are, in a lot of cases, very quickly no longer at the cutting edge. But looking at our volume, I don't feel that there's anything I would have liked to have had in there that we haven't got in there. We've realized that you can't do everything with a single volume, but I think we achieved what we set out to achieve with this book. And so I think we're both very happy with that, with the final product. But just to come back to what you said, Natasha, about history being, when you quoted from our introduction, history being used for political reasons. We mentioned this earlier. This is definitely one of the reasons we felt a book like this would be very timely. And I can't help but think that across Europe and in other parts of the world, also in the United States, many, many people have forgotten recent history. Some of them intentionally, but many of them maybe unintentionally, simply because they're not aware of what happened 75 years ago and more. And therefore, I think it's always important to remind people, because many of the political issues of our time have have so much to do with our recent past, with history, a failure to understand history, a very unfortunate ability to forget history or misinterpret it. So for that reason, I think historians do have a very important job to do.
I would just add one thing to that. Look, forgetting history is definitely a possibility, and you know, each new generation needs to be educated in these areas. What particularly worries me is how people who are not young people have very warped understandings of just exactly what took place inside their own countries. And you know, I think that's yes, in part what I think our book would like to address. At the same time, I'm also aware with a book like this, with the title that it has, even the cost that it has, the people who will be reading this are not people like that, right? But what we've got to try and transcend, what I think the real challenge for historians is to not necessarily keep writing books that are only for fellow academics so that we can make that next evolution. Yes, in part, that's part of what we would like to do. These are very, very targeted, very, very good, very, very well-researched articles that will contribute to a lot of those areas. It also gets, as we said, German, very high-class German works into an Anglo-American audience. But I think the challenge that we've really got to try and meet, and partly this, you know, interview and many others, is now trying to provide engagement, much larger engagement. I think that's got to become more and more part of the academic role, because it's no good for us to all know what went on and to be up with the latest literature. It's about school kids. It's about everyday people. It's particularly about getting, I think, good journalism out there. Journalism is obviously a dying craft, and more into political parties. Make them responsible for what they say, not just at the polling booth, but make them responsible by getting historians to write when they just manipulate, or they you know, there's all these shades of grey around exactly what words they use. And this is becoming very apparent in the last 5 years. This is a real problem for our field. And I think first and foremost, it's got to be historians holding these people to account in any way publicly that we possibly can. That's a real onus of responsibility. Otherwise, we're all left knowing what we know, and we may be right, but that doesn't help. Especially when there's, you know, social media that allow anyone to consume whatever politics they like in their own echo chamber with no corrective. We've got to get that corrective out there, because we're kind of losing the battle. It feels to me like we're sort of more and more percentages of people in various places, some countries better than others. And actually, Germany's very good in that regard. Germany's very well educated in its past, and partly that's also laws around what one can and cannot say here. I'm not proposing those laws for other countries. At the same time, they've worked very well in Germany in terms of, you know, you can't deny the Holocaust here, and other countries you can. And look where that's taken them. So we've got to stand up. We've got to have a responsibility. And I think historians have got to be, you know, very much a part of that. Just writing for each other is for me, no option.
I think it's great that you have that larger picture in mind, because that's kind of what the New Books Network is trying to do, is to reach beyond the ivory tower and these academics who just speak to each other. I want to commend you on your introduction, because not only did you provide an important framework and context for the articles that are to follow, but you did it with enough of your own voices and restraint to let the articles then speak for themselves. And it's kind of hard to find edited books where the editors aren't inserting how to think about each section on as they go. So thank you for your restraint, but your powerful words at the beginning.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's great to hear. We did debate it at length. As I said, we were considering a sort of classic historiographical essay on, you know, decades of evolutions in the historiography, but ended up going with something more like this, which now I think, you know, I'm glad you say that, but I think you're also right. I think that is the you know, one of the things I would like to take away from the book and, yeah, motivation.
Yeah, thank you for those comments, Natasha. I think we definitely did set out to give our contributors, our authors, a broad remit. You know, we did approach them with specific topics in mind, but we wanted to let them do the writing, and I think we achieved that. And it's also an approach I, for example, take in teaching, that sometimes students come to me who to supervise their bachelor theses or master theses, and one of their first questions is, are you going to give me a topic? Not because they want me to give them a topic, but because in Germany, often that's expected, that the professor gives the students topics. But I actually say to them, well, I don't think it's going to benefit either of us if you write your thesis on a topic that you're not really interested in so much. That's you're not going to write a good thesis if it's a topic that I've thrust on you. And therefore, I say, you know, I'm here to guide you. I'm here to advise you. But ultimately, I want you to write a thesis that that excites you, that you're invested in. So I think it's always better for the person doing the writing to actually come up with the bulk of the ideas themselves, rather than having these ideas thrust on them.
So I was hoping that both of you could talk about what you're currently working on, or any future books or research that you are planning.
Yes, it's quite a straightforward question for me, and very much related to the book we've been discussing over the past half an hour or so. I decided to pick up on this collection of essays and run with it and actually write a single author book on a history of Nazi mass killing. So really an integrative work on all of the major killing programs. Of course, the Holocaust, but also the genocide of Sinti and Roma, the elimination of the Polish elites, the murder of psychiatric patients, the starvation of Soviet prisoners of war and broad sections of the Soviet urban population, and the victims of the brutal anti-partisan operations. Because surprisingly, a book like this doesn't actually exist. So I'm currently under contract with Yale University Press to write that book. And it's going well. I'm making progress.
I think that's kind of interesting, if I can just pick that up. Part of the reason I said to Alex when he was talking about that as an idea is I thought, you know, if all of these areas are discussed separately and they have their own analysis, but their analysis is geared very much to that area of Nazi criminality, it's interesting to think, wow, there's all these connected and related areas of this, mass murder. What do we learn by putting them all together in one sort of narrative and then standing back and saying, well, what do we learn from that? So I'm kind of keen to see where that book goes and read it myself. Myself, I'm working on, well, I just had a book that came out end of 2019, so Retreat from Moscow. It's basically looking at, it's more an operational history. But my next project is, I think, one that's going to be very interesting for me because it's, yes, dealing with the sort of the area I'm often working on, which is the Wehrmacht's war in the East, but I've got the private letters of four German generals, and I'm doing a social study of these men. I say social study because I'm still trying to work out what exactly is this. But what is clear to me is, yes, it's the classic. I would like to know about German military operations and what they understand that to be, because these letters are something that we've never seen before. We know what these men thought from their orders in World War II or their post-war writings where they try to sell themselves as something very different. Those are the two basic source materials we have. Without having really ever looked at these letters, and that might sound interesting to some of your readers, like how come no one's ever looked at them, but a lot of them were written in a handwriting that people can't read anymore. So Alte Deutsche Schrift or Zitterlin. So believe it or not, there used to be a different alphabet that people wrote in. And so a lot of historians can't access these. Looking at what's written in those letters, myself, I wasn't sure what was in them. And you realize there's a huge amount of honesty in there. And I think that speaks to not just the military history that these men are so obviously involved with, but the whole of the Nazi state. How are they representing what's going on in the East to their wives? And at this point, I'll just leave that open. I'm still working on, as I say, what the book will be, but it's going to speak to a lot more than just military history. It's obviously looking at criminality as well.
Well, I wanted to thank you both. This has been a very enlightening and pleasurable interview, considering there's two of you on one side, and I can see how well you work together. And I look forward to hearing from both of you separately or as together in the future. So keep the New Books Network and the podcast in mind. Alex and David, I really appreciate you taking your time and discussing this with me, and I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Natasha. It was great talking to you again.